1 hour just to prepare ourselves to sleep, 3 hours sleep. Four people were working all the time, two people were just coming and going. And we made a number of experiments, which again confirmed those findings. And my understanding is that we're dealing at least with something we don't know yet with what we're dealing with. But I rather believe that I'm having something that is worth of the attention than something that is completely worthless. John, please speak up, sir.
Can I have it, Dick?
You got it? What are you gonna do with that? Go ahead, John.
Well, Dick, in your previous statement, you really said a mouthful, because I look at the TechNet as a bank of knowledge, and I make withdrawals every week. And we got a great bank manager, you, and we have all of this input from these very bright people. So this is only a portion of what we're learning, but you're absolutely right. We're discussing things that can be applied to anywhere when you extrapolate this data or the individual knowledge that we're learning about components. Now, I try to keep Wesley, I'm a good friend with him, but I am the antichrist with him, because I try to be the white line in the road, and you know, give him a little direction, and try to stay on target. That's a big thing with labs. And another thing you mentioned, I have a shelf full of lab notebooks. Most of them are failures, of course. I don't throw them out, but they're there if I need them. But I learned a lot from those mistakes, so I agree with you 100%. I'm back to you, Dick.
A good notebook where you record what you see objectively, you'd be amazed how many times in history somebody expected to get a particular result. He made 10 measurements, and two of those measurements were outliers. In other words, they fell off of the curve, and he rejected them and didn't record them. And some years later, somebody found out those outliers were indicating something real. And he recorded it, even though it didn't fit his impression of what he expected to get. You don't want to throw the baby out with the washwater. The whole reason you do an experiment is because there's something unknown. If you're doing research, there's got to be some partial unknown that you're trying to resolve. If you absolutely positively knew everything's going to happen, why bother doing the experiment? It's repetition of something you already know. So whenever you're really doing an experiment, when you're really doing some research, you're going to occasionally find things that surprise you. But one of the things way off subject, Wes, that I want to go into for a second that you mentioned, that you had an office in World Trade Center number 1. I am curious as to what floor of the building was your office, how many people did you have that worked with you, and I believe that that office ceased to exist on 9/11, 2011, on September 11th, and you were not, thank goodness you were not there that day. I am curious, were any of your fellow workers in the office on that particular day? What floor was it? How many workers were they there? And I know this is a very sad event for you. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, N2XJN. I was the president of company that was the scientific entity. We get across CDC NASA, Alexander Martins, who became a leading provider with number of government agencies that we work with. That was 77th floor. And I employed a few scientists, and we got a patent for resonance acoustical profiling system, which was a passive system to see beneath the ground everything that you could wish to see to the depth of 2 kilometers with one single problem. you didn't know what you see. In other words, if I had a clay and I had a gravel, I was able to determine and see perfectly all the variation between these two layers. I was able to see pipes and armature. That's why then we went across army, and it was army rangers in Georgia. That was Columbus, Georgia. It was in complete forest. I don't know if it was secret or was not secret. Anyhow, I was elected in front of 200 civil and military scientists. And that was at the time of Kosovo. I presented at that time the good application for that technology, which would be, they had a problem with Kosovo, and I suggested that could be a demilitarized path, like around with the bulldozers around the city, that nothing is there, and you simply drop a small sensors that would be wrapped resonance acoustic profiling sensors. They will be sensing the vibration with a small transmitter driven by piezoelectric, and then the uplink would be to the balloon that is a little bit higher, and the signal goes to the headquarters. This thing is so sensitive that it could measure number of people crossing that area. Let me jump. Then I was called to be a lecturer in Denver, Colorado, for the International Optic Conference. And at that time I was presenting the technology to the scientific world. With Federal Highway Administration, Department of Transportation, with Mr. Tom Lefchuk, who have been working on the roads of Virginia and Ohio, trying to find abandoned mines from 100 years ago. They were causing collapsing of the highways because nobody had a map on it. Full success. I was working with USG, United States Geophysical Survey, and plenty others. What else? NASA. We've been participating with a number of programs that were sponsored by DARPA, Department of Defense, and NASA. And that is my scientific part, if somebody is interested with it. Thank you, sir.
In your office on floor 77 of World Trade Center number 1, roughly how many employees were there on a good day, Wes? How many were there that particular day? Were some of those lives lost on that particular day over the U.S.?
Thanks God, nobody was hurt, nobody was in the office. Right shortly before that, we had two offices. One was in New Jersey, in Linden, New Jersey, and the other one was in World Trade Center 1. We decided that most of the job could be done in New Jersey, in Linden. And because of the high cost, $5,200 per 800 square meters, we've been tempted to really leave that location. So nobody was there. I was the president of the corporation, but I was I had two partners, the rich people. One of them was a president of import export export company, and the other one was a person who was working in a hospital as a maintenance man. One day, he woke up with $18.4 million in his pocket. He won the lotto. So, that was a good time. We went to Elko, Nevada, to Murari Gold Mine, and I was able for the first time in my life to see two parts of this gold mine. One was the underground, and I've seen the leaking cable for the communication. And the other one, let me jump, was actually it looks like a spiral. You have a 2 floors by 2 floor steps, and a very heavy trucks were going down to dig for the rock. Now, in that particular gold mine, nobody has ever seen a gold there, because the gold was in the rock. Chemically, the rock had to be crushed, taken to these big trucks, and then goes to the place where I was never had access to see how they get that gold from it. At that time, they were making approximately $125,000 per day of worth of the gold. Then we went to Kennecott Corporation, which is a copper industry. In the gold mine, they had another problem. The water was all of a sudden showing into the underground part of mine. And they did not know when is that going to happen. Also, one of the big steps started to slide. We've been able to see a map layer of the clay on the slope. When there was a rainy day, the water simply couldn't go inside, but start the slopes. We saved them approximately $5 million of damages. We weren't paid good, but that was okay at the time. Other projects, well, there was plenty of them. There was plenty of them. With NASA, we've been chosen with 475 companies participating in the program. The program was related to find a good technique for the robots going to the surface of Mars and find out what is beneath the ground. Three companies were chosen to the grant money. NASA decided to do not proceed with that, and that was probably because of lack of funds. From other things that I can recall. The device is very simple. You take a piezoelectric foil, very teeny one, and put it in any kind of enclosure, and simply place it on the surface of the ground. Then you take a wire out of it and connect it to analog to digital converter. And then you treat that signal with the DAS program with the Fourier analysis. After that, you deliver that to the photostyler or any kind of graphical program. Then you see the cutoff of the ground pretty nicely. At that time, I went to the idea of creating a geophysical bomb, which is not killing anybody. Absolutely not. Peaceful purpose, which could be deployed to the enemy territory, spread into the thousands of the pieces, each one of the pieces with the GPS showing exact location, with a spike on it, going into the ground and taking one measurement only. that could map underground bunkers and structures. I also thought about areas around the prisons or the Mexico border. Well, after September 11, I decided to part with the company. That was enough for me. I took my money and I sat silent for a number of years till the time when I met Dick with his technet and 2XGN.
Some of what you were describing earlier sounds a little bit like ground penetrating radar. Maybe it's a variation of that by either acoustic or electromagnetic or a combination of techniques. There's a lot of value in ground penetrating radar. Tremendous amounts of research has gone into that for the one particular purpose, to try to find landmines. I get the impression that you were looking at deeper structures, things like tunnels of a mine and things like this.
No, anything that you want. See, this is the only one known to me, geophysical device that is capable of extremely passive way of finding what is beneath the ground. All of the methods known to me, let's say, take the explosive one. You first sending the vibration, then you're trying to see what's going on from the pieces of what you've got that is reflected. Or you use ground penetrating radar and you're trying to do the same. How good is this? 6 meters? The maximum of 12 meters? Not even. 3 meters is the best. So this thing was going up to 2 kilometers. Very simple equation that was created for the purpose of this of the patent. We had a guy that I'm still in contact with. He's retired right now, Mr. Fitzpatrick. He was our patent agent, and I spent endless hours with him trying to prepare that patent for it. Anyhow, it was a good time, good experience. you asked me for the story, I gave it to you.
Yes, I did.
To LDY.
LDY recognized. Get to you in a second. Sounds like a very valuable patent. Who was the assigned? When you apply for a patent, it is usually assigned to a particular corporation.
Yes, it was my corporation.
Okay. And was it assigned to your name, Olejnik or Olejnik? Was it? Were you listed as one of the inventors?
No, there was a teamwork, but because we have had a gentleman that I had a great respect to, I decided to voluntarily give up rights to the patent and left all of the glory to him, although the patent was assigned 100% to my corporation. So there was Igor Zhukov, and if you Google for me, you would be able probably to find some of the information of the World Trade Center and me on the Google. I was still able to find somewhere on 20th pages. Now, you got to understand, Internet at that time was not that advanced as it is right now. Back to you.
But you said it was your corporation that it was assigned to. It wasn't your name, it was other names. If I look under corporation for that particular patent, what corporation would I look for, Wes?
Environmental Investigation Corporation.
Environmental Investigation Corporation. Good name. Mr. LDY, give me your full call letters. I should know you. And then your question or comment. LZY, K2LIW.
Okay. The call sign is November 2, Lima, Delta Yankee. The first personal is Dawn, Delta Oscar, November. And I just have a ham-related question and maybe a green question after that, not pertaining to the subject that you guys are talking about right this second. I've been trying to get in there, but I think you guys are guilty of quick keying or something, because I've been sitting here for the last hour or so trying to get in without success. Repeat is, when a repeater has to ID, what is the time frame that the repeater has to ID in, or how does that work?
To be legal, a repeater or a ham radio operator, everything by FCC rules, must identify once per 10 minutes, was the rules that I remember, Don. And you got a nice signal from center reach. I think you're coming into the Western machine. Was that your main question, Don? Go ahead.
Sort of. But so if a repeater is sitting there up on the hill, right, and no one's on it, like, okay, it's the middle of the night, it's required every 10 minutes to identify?
Not at all. If it's not doing any transmitting, no identification is required. Now, some repeaters, just because of the way the repeater owner set it up, it comes on once every 10 minutes or once every half hour, even though nobody is using it, and it identifies. It doesn't have to. Only when it's making a transmission must every transmission be identified at least once per 10 minutes. So if you're on the air, once per 10 minutes, you're going to identify. If you're off the air, no identification is required, to my understanding. Don, go ahead.
Okay. Well, then that makes more sense to me. Because I was thinking to myself, you know, the other night, you know what I'm saying? Well, if these repeaters, you know, are identifying, you know, every 10 minutes or 15 minutes or half an hour, I mean, you think about the power that, you know, each repeater is using, you know, and how many there are, you know, scattered around the whole planet, let's say. I mean, that's, you know, essentially quite a bit of power. If there were some way they could decrease, you know, the amount of times they identify, even if the individual owners of said repeater, you know, might consider just letting it go dormant unless somebody is using it, it may save a considerable amount of power, and it may be a more greener thing to do, you know, and I just was wondering if anyone had considered that.
I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding the concept that you're conveying now. I just suddenly realized what you're doing, Don. Part of the reason you had trouble coming in is, yes, we're too quick on keying, and you're coming through the Eastern machine, the 975-375 machine, and every so often that machine gets dropped out because of an error in its way its computer operates, and also because we time it out.
And so back to K2RIW is?
Yeah. Maybe I talked on top of you a little bit. I'm not quite sure of the concept that you're conveying, Don. The fact that there are multiple repeaters... The fact that there are multiple repeaters scattered around the United States, some of them on the same frequency, on some of them on different frequency, you sound like you want to tie them together in such a way that you save energy. Each repeater has got a certain area of coverage, a little bit like a cell site. So why would you want to tie them together and still cover each of those areas? I'm missing something on what you're conveying, Don. N2LDY, K2RIW.
Ooh, I never said tie them together. I just said, like, let's say this said repeater, right? If it was set up to identify, you know, every 10 minutes, you know, irregardless of the fact that anyone was on it or not, it would consume a certain amount of power each time it fired up and keyed up and did the ID and set that out. Plus, it would actually actually shorten the life of the electronics. Well, if it were tube-based, it would shorten the life of the tube, that is. But I meant just as a green option, I would think that people would want to set it so that it would have to do the least amount of work or use the least amount of power. Over.
The least amount of power would be to never transmit at all if no one's using it. Some of the repeaters, because of the way the repeater owner set it up, that he wants to let everyone know that there's an active repeater on that frequency so they don't think it's dead and they don't think they can go and apply for that frequency. In order to avoid that problem, they set it up in such a way that even if no one's using it, it comes on every 10 minutes or so and identifies. That is not an FCC requirement. If the repeater hasn't turned on because no one's using it, then for the next 12 hours, it does not have to identify, so to speak. It only has to identify when it's being used, when it's on the air. So if you want the most green repeater, you only identify the minimum amount of time required for the FCC requirement, which is once per 10 minutes when it's on the air. Over to you, Don. N2LDY, K2RIW.
KC2RFM.
Don first, and then Alan after that. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, that that answers my question. I was, just thinking about that. You know how, the power loss, over, in, let's just say the United States or something. How much you might be able to save. I'll give it back to that other station that was breaking, and I'll be on the side.
Very fine, Don. And sign in some more often. We haven't heard from you very often. And Alan? Alan's the guy who nominated the TechNet for the award that it got last year. Am I misinterpreting, Alan? I don't think a repeater has to identify when it's not on the air. But maybe there's something I didn't know about that. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I don't remember the rules for that, Dick, but it sounds like you're right there. And, of course, I was sad to hear about Mel. He'll be missed, obviously. That's a real loss. He was what I really call a radio man to the core. Lament his loss. Of course, my best out to his family. Don brought up green, and I'm wondering what the difference is between green and just efficiency. I see green more or less as a pejorative term almost, but it's, it's couched in environmentalism and all this. To me, green doing something green means, we're suffering or humans are suffering or taking a step backwards. Whereas, greater efficiency, that speaks for itself. So I was wondering what the difference is with respect to this reference to green.
I'm guessing, Alan, that green has many definitions depending on which group and what they're talking about. I just recently bought a new Whirlpool washing machine that does clothes washing. And it claims to be green. It claims to be green and energy efficient because it uses less electricity. All of the motors inside are brushless DC motors, no belts, no frictional devices to stop the drum. The drum gets stopped by electronic braking. By way of the brushless DC motors, it takes the rotary energy of the drum and couples it back into the 110-volt line. It uses an extremely small amount of water compared to my normal clothes washing machine. My normal clothes washing machine would fill up the tub with soapy water and then agitate that water. This thing doesn't do that. This thing takes a small amount of water with a so-called high-efficiency detergent, and it pours the water onto the clothing, spins the water out of the clothing, pours the same water back onto the clothing multiple times. And so a very small amount of water is used, very little agitation, and a very different cleaning process, and yet according to the Consumer's Report, let me drop. According to the Consumer's Report, it does an extremely good job of cleaning. I'm very happy with the clothes. They smell good, they look clean. So this thing uses a very small amount of electricity, a very small amount of water, and does a very good cleaning job. So in that particular case, this more efficient machine, this more green machine, did not create a compromise in the performance that I desire. So they seem to have had their cake and eat it too, if you know what I mean. So there are some success stories that I can see, and Whirlpool apparently put a lot of engineering into this thing, and Consumers Report gave them quite an accolade, said it was the best buy. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN. I heard somebody in there with too staticky. Well, that just sounds like they made a more efficient washer. And by the way, I also bought the high efficiency machines, which are great, even better than the standard, use less water, so on and so forth. But I bought it because it was more efficient. It used less water, so I had a lower water bill, and probably used maybe a little bit less electricity because it was much newer than the 15-year-old machine I had prior. But I always chide when I hear the word green because I don't see how that invented concept can take the place of just more efficient. I just never understood that. Maybe Don can tell us, since he was concerned about the green aspects of repeaters IDing themselves.
A very noisy N2Z Echo Alpha. We'll get to you in a second. The word green, I think, is very loose in its definition. From my point of view, something that's green is a way of, say, for instance, fertilizing your lawn without contaminating the water supply, running your house with very good insulation so you're not pouring a lot of heat outside and burning a lot of excess oil. These, to me, are green concepts. If I make the house more efficient in thermal characteristics, I burn less oil, I create less carbon loading of the atmosphere, I spend less money on oil, I create less of a problem of oil jumping up in price because of supply and demand problems, more oil is left over for industrial purposes and to run those tractor-trailer trucks and to run those factories. So those, to me, would be green concepts. And yes, there's a kind of a big overlap and non-overlap in areas as to efficiency versus green. Green implies non-contamination as well as efficient. I can have a very efficient method of fertilizing my lawn as far as what I pay and how green the lawn gets, but it could be very non-green because the chemistry is contaminating the water supply. So there is a real difference between green and efficiency in my mind. But I ain't sure. But I guarantee the definition is going to be a little bit spongy when you and I finally find it, whatever it is. N2, Z Echo Alpha, I think it is. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Glenn, Gulf River, Echo November. I've got 2 antennas sitting on the roof for quite a number of years, and mainly the SWR has gone off the scale. Where do I start looking for the problem, and what's the first step?
Okay, your signal through the machine is so noisy that almost no one is hearing it. I'm hearing you on the input. And on the input, you're asking me, you've got an antenna on the roof, it's got a high VisWire, where do you start looking to find out where the VisWire is? That's what I think the question is. And so, when you got standing wave ratio measured in the shack, your next question, is it coming from the cable or the antenna? A simple test to confirm that whether or not it's the cable is to put a reasonably known 50-ohm dummy load at the far end of the cable. In other words, disconnect the antenna and put a dummy load there. Then measure the VisWire. If the VisWire on the shack is good, your cable is good. All the connectors in the cable is good. The only thing left then is the antenna. 89% of the time, when you get VisWire, it's because of the antenna. The other 11% of the time, I'm picking numbers out of the air, are because there's water in the cable, a connector has come loose, and so on. So you want to do a divide and conquer. Is it the cable, or is it the antenna? N2, Z Echo Alpha, or Golf Echo Alpha, I can't tell for sure, K2RIW. Start off with your name. Go ahead. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. It's Glenn. Golf, Lima, Echo, remember, and oh, one of the two, Red Echo Alpha. Okay, that's the plan. I can start doing that. Thank you for the help.
Very fine, Glenn. Okay, yeah, you got to divide and conquer. In an antenna system, it's either the transmission line or the antenna. It's essentially nothing else. Oh, there's a slim possibility that a tree fell in front of the antenna and bent the elements, or there's a big chunk of metal in front of the antenna, so to speak, but and it's not the antenna itself, it's the environment it's in. That's a rare case. Good luck with that project. Okay, so Environmental Investigation Corporation, I think is the name of your company.
You can also find me if you go to HBR programs. I was a principal investigator in a number of the DARPA and Department of Defense programs, also NASA programs. The program that I was talking about, the device, was called, if I remember correctly, Extraterrestrial Exploration of Underground of Planets and Their Moons.
Okay, you gave us the name, but you said it so fast I didn't catch it. What was that name again at the end? Wesley, go ahead.
If I remember correctly, it was so many years ago. Extraterrestrial Exploration of Underground of Planets and Their Moons.
Extraterrestrial Exploration of Planets and Their Moons. Was that it?
Of Underground of Planets and Their Moons.
Okay, that is a mouthful. Extraterrestrial Exploration of Underground Planets and Their Moons. Wow. When you put that together as an acronym, is that pronounceable?
I don't know. I have tons of papers. Tons of papers. Honestly, 150 kilograms of papers from that time, from all of these government programs that we have. One of the programs was for DARPA, that was underground mine detections. plenty of them. I don't remember that. But the question that I have for you, Dick, is did you have a chance to look at the revision one of the email that I have sent you?
Very briefly, I did look at some of the new emails, portions of them. One of them was a rather long, very nicely done document about Tesla's concepts of magnetic coupling, where you can have a physical connection between a motor and generator, or you can have magnetic coupling, magnetic kickback, I call it, and various ways of doing that with coils. So the magnetic coupling, he makes it sound like it's much more desirable. And also you've got a much better, clearer schematic diagram with physical, isometric drawings. So I've got a better view of the caduceus coil and the distributed inductance capacitor and the way they're interconnected. It's a very unusual circuit, very unusual component. You've got a capacitor that's not a capacitor, an inductor that's not an inductor, and so on. And the caduceus coil has got the very unusual winding and spark gaps and whatever. It's an elaborate circuit, unusual circuit, and very unusual claims as far as its performance is concerned. So I've seen the better schematic. I've seen the Tesla information with those beautiful diagrams. That's how much I've seen so far, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
I would like to go to one of the schematics, which is called version 1, but version 2, and analyze this with you, and then right beneath that there is a Creon made, I call it tri-dimensional schematic, that will show exactly the same device, but instead of pickup coil, it does have a coil capacitor. Now, because the audience might be a little bit tired with this heavy stuff, I could suggest for the relax. I have sent you like an hour ago, not even that, an email with a video that is a short video. John would be able to give you some details about it. The claim over there is that magnetic dipoles are not visible. The guy took the aquarium, he put a metal plate beneath, he put a magnet on it, he treated it with the electric current, and then you see the vortex. He flipped the magnet, and then you see the vortex in different way, in different direction. John, maybe you would be able to explain it better.
Yeah, Dick, it looks like he took a neodymium magnet, placed it on a metal plate, which has a wire going out, filled it with water, and then took the other electrode and touched the top of the magnet. And if you look at that, how the water is disturbed, generates a vortex. It looks like a vortex of bubbles. And his claim, very short video, and I think you'd like that. And if he does turn the magnet around and do the same thing, the vortex runs in the other direction. Interesting.
Magnetic vortex spin demonstration. Yeah, I'm looking at that one right now. And I think you're talking, I'm only looking at the beginning of it so far, as he pours water on the top of this magnet, which I presume is being super cooled, but I'm not sure. I'm seeing the cloud around the magnet spin in a particular direction. And I think you're saying that when he turns the magnet around and repeats, the cloud around the magnet is going to spin in the opposite direction. Yeah, I see him reversing the magnet right now. And I wonder if the magnet is being cryogenically cooled. And yes, sure enough, when he pours water on it, the cloud, the vortex around it spins in the other direction. I think that's what we're talking about, and quite possibly we're asking, why does it do that? Is that what's going on, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Yes, Dick, I found that very interesting. I don't think there's any cryogenics involved, but if you notice, he brings the other electrode in and touches the top of that magnet. I assume that's a DC supply he's using. I don't think that information's there, but the effect is very interesting.
If there's no cryogenics involved, and he's pouring water on a magnet, what's making the cloud?
I'm not sure.
Magnetic dipoles being invisible, and magnetic field cannot physically affect the matter around it that is I don't know the wording to use. John?
You mean non-ferrous? I don't know. Do you think, Dick, that the cloud you're seeing could be ice crystals?
Right now, I don't know if the magnet is being cooled or heated. Why are there bubbles on that sheet that the magnet is sitting on? What's your guess?
It's probably electrolyzed water. Are you looking at hydrogen bubbles?
But to electrolyze water, you require at least two contacts. Where are the two contacts, Alan?
You
have someone to electrolyze the setup.
Okay. That was a double. Alan first, go ahead.
So I asked somebody to describe the setup.
Go ahead, John.
We have a glass beaker with a metal plate laying on the bottom. There's one conductor coming out of the flask. The magnet is set on top of that piece of metal. Then he brings another wire in, assuming it's DC, and touches the top of the magnet. And that's when you see the display of the vortex. So it could be electrolysis. Sure.
Yeah. Okay, if electrolysis is taking place, then hydrogen is coming off one terminal somewhere, and oxygen is coming off another terminal somewhere else. But the oxygen and the hydrogen themselves are not a plasma. These are just taking H2O and breaking it down into H and to O. Why is there smoke, and why is the smoke circulating? The smoke was circulating. If I've got vapor that wants to rise, and if the vapor is a conductive substance, and if that conductive substance wants to rise in the presence of a magnetic field, then we're going to get the Faraday deflection characteristics. In other words, a charged item moving in a magnetic field experiences a right angle deflection. But is the cloud charged? I guess it's possible for those individual particles of the cloud to somehow be charged. But we're not quite sure from what we see what is charging that cloud or what is making the cloud in the first place. Let me ask each one of you guys one at a time. Wesley, you got a guess as to what's making the cloud in 2XJN, K2LIW?
In 2XJN. Definitely there is the influence of the magnetic field, but my suggestion is if we have anything that is ionizing, we have a movement of the electrons. The electrons could be attracted or by the metal structure of the magnet. But why it is a vortex, I don't know. John?
No, I don't know either. Dick?
If the method by which I make the individual particles of the cloud allows them to have a positive or negative charge, and if the cloud particles are lighter in density than the air around, so that they want to rise, if I've got charged particles rising in a magnetic field, they're going to experience a right angle deflection. The right angle deflection means that they're going to rise in a spiral manner. So charged particles rising in a magnetic field are going to spin clockwise, reverse the magnetic field, they'll spin counterclockwise. So he does have rising cloud, he has vortex of spinning particles. It says that by some means, those particles have a charge. That's what I think he's saying. So there's a positive or negative charge on those individual cloud particles. That's the way I see it.
Dick, you just said something important. What is happening there is that we have interaction with the steady magnetic field of the neodymium magnet. Do you know any device that could couple in the motion manner the steady magnetic field with no winding on it? I don't know about such thing. That's what is interesting that I notice.
There's one other thing we might be missing, John.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I believe if you look at the beginning, now I forget because it was yesterday when I looked at it, did he put an insulator between the magnet and the metal plate?
No, I don't think so.
I think there is. He's got something there. There is what looks like a sheet of Teflon in between the sheet of metal and the magnet. And when he turns the whole thing upside down, he's showing us that there is a wire going through the sheet of metal, through the piece of Teflon, and touching the magnet. So I'm getting the impression that the magnet is charged, maybe with high voltage, compared to the metal plate underneath. That means that by whatever means he's making those cloud particles in that vicinity, because they're being charged by being close to the magnet, you therefore have charged particles rising in the magnetic field, and they're going to experience this right angle deflection, which we call a vortex. So that wire that he showed us from the bottom, I think is putting a high voltage on the magnet compared to the metal plate underneath. That's what I'm beginning to see. Over to you, Wes, KQRIW.
If there is a high voltage on the wire and it's DC, it doesn't make any difference. You have one charge only, and you have a difference of potentials, and the water has to be distilled. Do you agree with me?
I don't know if the water has to be distilled. And by the way, he could have reversed the vortex by either reversing the magnetic field or reversing the polarity of the voltage he's putting onto the magnet. He could do either one. I'm trying to think now. If you're making a cloud chamber, yeah, they pull a vacuum to make the cloud. He's not pulling a vacuum here. It's not clear how he's making the cloud. But I think he could have reversed the polarity as well as reversing the magnet in order to reverse the vortex. KQRIW.
Dick, could there be some outgassing between the plate and the magnet?
If it is water that he's pouring on the magnet, what would make the water turn into steam? If it was in a partial vacuum, yes, but this looks like a short sleeve environment, so that's not explaining it. And is the magnet heated so much that the water is boiling? I'm skeptical of that. The cloud looks like it's... Is it possible that we got dry ice involved here? I know that when you pour water on dry ice, you get steam. Or just the dry ice itself evaporating. There's a lot of missing information as to what's going on.
Dick, when you take a fresh water from the faucet, you have the bubbles. And when you put something that is of different temperature right to the water, you have the bubbles on the surface of this metal. Do you agree with that?
As he pours water on that magnet, I see the cloud forming immediately. I'm not seeing the cloud coming from bubbles from below. There are some bubbles, but there's not enough bubbles breaking fast enough to make that cloud. Right now, where that cloud is coming from is not clear.
Does it look like the bubbles are emanating from the lower part of the magnet, or is it uniform?
I haven't listened to the audio yet, and I wonder if that's going to give us any explanation. But as he pours water on that magnet, my impression is that the cloud begins at the bottom. Yes. When I see the beginning, I'm seeing the cloud start from the bottom. I'm seeing water droplets forming on the side of the magnet. Is it really water that he's pouring? Did he say it's water? Over to you, John.
Dick, I don't know. And I don't know if it's water with any chemicals or elements in it. Don't know.
For me, important is that the vortex is created. The interaction between steady state magnetic field of the steady of the neodymium magnet is established in form of the vortex. The motion is created by steady state, and that for me is very interesting.
I have to set it up and do it myself.
I'm guessing he is pouring liquid nitrogen on that magnet. That's not water. He's pouring liquid nitrogen. The liquid nitrogen is boiling off. It's making a cloud. The magnet has got a charged voltage on it. So now he's charging the particles of liquid nitrogen as it turns into gaseous nitrogen. And now it's responding to the magnetic field as it rises.
I don't agree.
Agree. He puts his hand into it.
He can put his hand onto the magnet if he hasn't poured enough liquid nitrogen on it to truly cool off the magnet. Would a cloud of liquid nitrogen that's boiling off be a rising cloud or a sinking cloud?
The difference between the water and the nitrogen. You will see the difference on it. And if it's only the nitrogen, then he wouldn't be able to put his hand into it.
The ambient moisture would condense on the glass and freeze on the beaker itself on the outside. That was my experience in all the nitrogen I've used.
When he turns it upside down and you see the actual high voltage wire, I see what looks like a freezing material around that wire. I'm not convinced that he's pouring water. He's pouring some other substance onto that magnet.
For me, it looks like a fresh water with a lot of gas in it, right put out of the faucet, and that's why you have a condensation. You've seen that in your life.
As I look at the movie again, he is not pouring a liquid. He is reaching a wire to the upper diaphragm of the chamber. He's reaching the wire through and touching the magnet. When the wire touches the magnet, a cloud is given off. So the high voltage touching the magnet is doing something that makes the cloud.
So, do you gentlemen have any answer for it? Maybe somebody from the audience.
What do you believe is the question? He is touching the magnet with a wire. There's some kind of a substance between the bottom of the magnet and the bottom plate. Whatever that substance is, in the presence of high voltage, it gives off a cloud of material.
Maybe it's an Alka-Seltzer tablet.
It's an Alka-Seltzer tablet that only gives off smoke when it's touched with a wire. There's something else going on. Each time the wire touches the top of the magnet, a cloud is given off. Yeah, as I see it, he is not pouring a fluid. At first, you guys thought he's pouring a fluid. He is touching the top of the magnet, which is insulated from the bottom sheet with some kind of a white insulator. There's some kind of a fluid down there. When he touches the wire to the top of the magnet, a cloud is given off.
Looks like we're not going to have the answer before John will not make the experiment, but Dick, question for you. Do you know of any technique that you can couple motion to the steady state magnetic field?
I hear the words, but I'm not quite sure what the question is. If I've got a coil that is moving through a magnetic field, by Faraday's law, I'm going to induce a voltage on that coil. So if you want to measure what's going on with a steady state magnetic field, it takes a Hall effect device. If you want to couple energy out of the magnetic field, it takes a moving coil of wire to do that. Maybe that's some of the answer you're looking for. KQLIW, over to you, Wes.
Whenever you have a coil, you have the inductance and capacitance. We say that we're dealing with the capacitance in here. We might not really have any kind of the LC network in here, but even though that we have, the nature of the vortex is unexplained. I'm trying to find out, whenever we have a magnetic field, we tend to say the work is not being done. But that would be a documentation of the work in progress. And 2XGM.
In this particular YouTube video, are you saying there's still a question as to why the rising smoke spins clockwise in one case and counterclockwise in the other case. Are you saying that that is unexplained, Wes? Go ahead.
No,